from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon and Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas met for the first time today in Sharm el-Sheikh, Egypt. The meeting, the first between top Israeli and Palestinian leaders in 5 years, marked a hopeful step in a blood-soaked relationship, a step that had appeared impossible before the death of Yasser Arafat and after 4 years of Palestinian violence and crushing Israeli military retaliation that together left 4,000 dead. Today, Arafat's successor, Mahmoud Abbas, committed to ending attacks against Israel. And Sharon said he, too, would step back from violence, would push Israel toward a lasting truce. It's been a bloody path. But today in Egypt, there was excitement and the sense of new possibilities. Tonight on Point, new hope for peace in the Middle East. We'll hear from the Palestinian Sari Nusebe, Israeli peace advocate Yossi Beilin, from Tough Voices, seasoned observers, and from you. We begin tonight in Sharm el-Sheikh, Egypt, where Abbas and Sharon met today with Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak and Jordan's King Abdullah II. Stephen Erlanger is Jerusalem bureau chief for the New York Times and was in Sharm el-Sheikh for today's big summit. I asked him to describe the mood there.
Well, the mood is actually very, very good. The Israelis have been hoping for someone they could talk to after Arafat finally died, and they have that person in Mahmoud Abbas, but they're also worried that he's weak still and that he won't be able to deliver. But the mood was surprisingly good and cordial. Sharon and Mubarak seem to get on. They're exactly the same age. There is a sense that at least now that no one's in uniform and wearing a keffiyeh, that some real business can be done.
That is, Yasser Arafat has gone from the scene. And yet, as you report, both Abbas and Sharon, despite the headlines we're seeing, they were careful not to use the word ceasefire. If that's what they intend, why didn't they just say it explicitly?
The Israelis explain it this way. They say a ceasefire you can only have with a real state that has full control over its forces, that you can't make a ceasefire with what they call terrorist groups. And they're very worried that this truce, which is really what it is, will not last, and that until Mahmoud Abbas moves against Hamas and moves to dismantle what they call the infrastructure of terrorism, it will leave groups like Hamas with a veto over any ceasefire because they can break it any time. Now, there's a lot of semantics in this, but the Israelis convinced the Palestinians, this was part of the negotiation, not to use the word ceasefire. So both Abbas and Sharon very carefully talked about ending or ceasing all acts of violence, and that was language agreed upon by both sides.
That much they have come out with. What else have these two leaders come away from Sharm el-Sheikh with, Steve Erlanger?
What they've done is important. I mean, if the bloodshed stops, it will change everybody's lives, and it will make it easier for Sharon to pull out of Gaza, and it will make it easier for Abbas to do the kind of internal reforms that he needs to do. The other specifics, which have been coming out in dribs and drabs, are a committee to talk about the release of longer-term Palestinian prisoners. In other words, prisoners who'd been in jail since before 1993 in the Oslo Accords, who'd been convicted of, you know, as the Israelis say, having blood on their hands. The Palestinians want them out, so at least there's going to be a committee to talk about it. There is an agreement for the Israelis to pull back from at least five of the major Palestinian cities within the next 3 weeks. There is an Israeli agreement, which is part of its cessation of military activity, not to hunt down wanted Palestinians, to end targeted killings, to only go after people that they know are in the midst of actually doing an act that could lead to the death of Israeli civilians. And those are really the main points. The problem today was a statement by Hamas spokesman, Hamas being the radical Islamic group, saying that Mr. Abbas's declaration does not bind them. This may be rhetorical. This may be a way to remind Palestinians that Hamas has been fighting the occupation, not making concessions to it. But it does underscore the fragility of Mr. Abbas's authority and his position, and hence the fragility of this entire ceasefire.
So Israel agreeing to release already, I guess, 900 out of 8,000 Palestinian prisoners, maybe more, as you say, and Hamas rattling its sword already in the background. Forward momentum would seem very important here. Talk of a kind of stand down on violence today, but what about positive statements about moving forward to actually negotiate a peace settlement? Is that in the air? Is there a timetable?
To be honest, the Palestinians want to move rather quickly to those kinds of discussions. The Israelis say, look, we did that with Oslo. That doesn't get us anywhere. The first thing we need to do is trust each other. The best way to trust each other is to stop killing each other, which they've begun today. And the best way to know that the killing will stop is for you, as you've promised in the first stage of peace plan called the roadmap, you Palestinians, to dismantle the structure of terrorism, in other words, move against Hamas. Now, Abbas doesn't want to do that, nor do the Israelis want to do what they're supposed to do in the first stage of the roadmap, which is to dismantle illegal outposts on the West Bank and illegal settlement activity. They deal with their plan to pull out of Gaza, they have enough on their plate. So while they accuse the Palestinians of not fulfilling their promises in the first stage of the roadmap, the Israelis say they don't need to do their parallel obligations yet. There are all kinds of problems, and all this is in the way of substantive negotiations on peace. The Israelis say we're not anywhere near there yet, and Abbas needs to show his people that all this talk with the Israelis is going to lead somewhere. It has to have a political horizon. And that's really another one of the gaps that nobody wanted to talk much about today.
Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak and Jordan's King Abdullah II at the table along with Sharon and Abbas. What does their presence say about where things stand and where they might go?
Well, I think it's very important. Partly it gives the stamp of approval to Abbas and his nonviolent position, his turning away from the armed or militarized uprising called the Intifada. And it also gives Sharon a boost. I mean, this is Sharon's only his second visit to an Arab country since he became prime minister. He had never been to Egypt as prime minister. And for him to sit around the table with these guys and have the Israeli flag there felt in some ways rather normal. It was a sign of acceptance in some odd way. And Mubarak, the same age as Sharon, has made it very clear to the Palestinians in public that Sharon is the guy they need to do business with.
And finally, Steve, what about Washington? Condoleezza Rice, effusive today, hailing this as the best chance for peace we are likely to see for some years. And, of course, Lieutenant General William Ward being assigned to the region by President Bush. What is expected, what is committed by Washington in terms of getting peace talks going?
Well, not very much, to be honest. I mean, Ms. Rice's visit, she had two things on her mind. One was to say to the Israelis, look, the United States is your friend. We get it. We understand terrorism matters. Don't worry. You can take risks. The United States is with you. And on the other hand, her message to the Israelis is, this guy Abbas is a great guy. He's your best opportunity. Don't screw it up. Now, those are sort of contradictory messages, but that was what she wanted to say. And to the Palestinians, she wanted to say, you can't keep fooling us. You really do have to move against terrorism. You have to make declarations of nonviolence real. If you don't move against Hamas, it will damage everything in the long run. So no one expects you to do it tomorrow, but you don't have an unlimited amount of time. And there are things you can do. You can dismantle factories that make rockets and mortars. You can take away illegal weapons. You can get rid of weapons caches. You can arrest people who commit acts of terrorism. So she has been trying to send these messages. To some degree, not having her at Sharm was a good thing, because so often these meetings, it looks like the Americans have herded all these unhappy people into a room for photo opportunity. This time, under the Egyptian flag, it looked in a way more natural.
Steve Erlanger in Sharm el-Sheikh, always great hearing from you. Thanks so much for being with us tonight.
Thanks, Tom.
Stephen Erlanger is Jerusalem bureau chief for the New York Times. He spoke with me from Sharm el-Sheikh, Egypt, Joining me in the studio tonight is Sari Nusseibeh. He's a high-profile Palestinian leader and president of Al-Quds University, the Arab University of Jerusalem, where he's also a professor of philosophy. He's currently a Radcliffe Institute Fellow at Harvard University. He has been, for years, deep in the tangled Israeli-Palestinian conversation. Sari Nusseibeh, wonderful to have you with us tonight.
Thank you very much.
We've just got a minute before the break. There's a lot more I want to ask you about. But just your first impressions, your first response to the fact of this meeting of Sharon and Abbas in Sharm el-Sheikh today?
Well, I think it's a great meeting. I think that it opens the door for a new kind of relationship between the Palestinians and the Israelis. I think all of us have to support the outcome of those talks in every way we can. But it's still just a beginning. And a lot has to be followed up.
And apart from the now absence of Yasser Arafat, have other fundamentals changed?
Oh, yes. I don't personally believe that, of course, Yasser Arafat's death is one component, but I do not subscribe to the view that it's the only or the most important component of what's happening at the moment. There are changes taking place on the ground, the changes in U.S. policy, changes in attitudes on the part of the Israelis, on the part of the Palestinians after 4 years of fighting. I think the ground is ripe, the time is opportune for a strategic change, and I think that the opportunity is indeed there and will probably, as Condoleezza Rice said, will be the best for many years to come.
So you're joining the chorus of hope. We want to come back and talk about that strategic change in point of view that leads you to that view. Sari Nusseibeh, please stand by. We've got to take a short break here. We are talking tonight about new hope in the Middle East for peace after today's big summit in Sharm el-Sheikh. You can join the conversation. Do Israeli and Palestinian handshakes mean this time that a new day might be dawning? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the Mideast Summit in Egypt, a new hope for peace coming out of Sharm el-Sheikh. In Egypt today, Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas pledged to end violence toward Israel.
We agreed, me and Mr. Sharon, Prime Minister, to stop all violence work against Israel by Palestinians anywhere. And this quiet time, which our lands will see starting from today until a new era for a start of a peace and hope.
And Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon said he would push for a peaceful two-state solution.
Only actions and not talking. This is the only way to reach a position of two states that will live in peace and quietly, one side by side.
Sounds of hope from the Middle East today, and it's been a long time. You can join our conversation tonight. After 4 years of fighting and 4,000 dead, are both sides ready to come to the table this time? And beyond Yasser Arafat's departure, have the fundamentals changed in this conflict? Is it time for hope? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm joined tonight in the studio, and very glad to be so, by Sari Nusseibeh. He's president of Al-Quds University, the Arab University of Jerusalem, leading Palestinian thinker, very prominent for years in the conversation that's gone on there. Sari Nusseibeh, you were saying before the break that the time is ripe for strategic change. I take that to mean in the kind of fundamental stance of each side here. How so?
Well, I think that it's evident from the facts, the data that one has, that in Israel, for example, you'll find that there's an overwhelming majority now who are in favor of a definitive peace settlement with the Palestinians that's based on allowing the Palestinians to have their own state, again, based on the 1967 borders. And in Palestine, within the Palestinian community, that's to say in the West Bank and Gaza, similar data show that, and opinion polls and so on, that a majority of the Palestinians are now ready to reach agreement with the Israelis, again on the basis of a two-state settlement. However, I'd like to say that it is essential, in my opinion at this stage, for us to be able to make use of the present opportunity. In fact, to focus on the horizon, on the political horizon, to focus on the end game. And I would suggest that one of the reasons, in fact, for the failure of the talks between the Palestinians and the Israelis in the past 10 years, and one of the reasons for the failure in the past 4 or 5 years to get anywhere, is the fact that the two sides, and I mean by the two sides, the leaderships on both sides, have not come out openly and clearly to state exactly what the end game, in their view, is going to be. And it's going to be very, very hard if that doesn't happen, for instance, for Abu Mazen or Mahmoud Abbas, to be able to carry out the kind of activity against people who carry guns or want to use them, which is required by the roadmap. So it's essential, in my opinion, to go to move as fast as possible now, to make use of this opportunity and define the end game.
But what if Israel lays out its end game, what it's willing to live with at the end? And, of course, neither side's been willing, as you say, ever been willing to fully do that here. What if they do that and the Palestinians don't like what they hear?
Well, so it's better for this to happen now than for it to happen later, because a few years down the road, it's going to cause a major collapse, not only in the peace talks or in the situation, but in the entire stability of the region. I think it's important for the two sides to come out and state their end game. And I believe that the end game can actually be defined very clearly on the basis of course, international legal resolutions, United Nations resolutions, but also on the basis of what the people themselves in Israel and in Palestine are prepared to accept.
You think that the end games of these two peoples are compatible?
Well, I think, you know, the interests of both sides dictates, requires that both sides make the necessary choices, make the necessary compromises, in order to be able to come out with a settlement that's acceptable to the two sides. Israel cannot, on the one hand, afford to continue its occupation of the Palestinians because of its own self-interest, because of its self-definition.
Why not?
As a
Why
Jewish
can't
state.
It? It's done it for a long time now.
It's done it for a long time, but as you know, there's a growing number of Arab population under its regulatory authority.
On the West
and
Bank and
on
Gaza.
The West Bank and Gaza, but, you know, also you have to take into account there are already 1 million Arabs anyway who are Israeli citizens.
Within the boundaries
Within
of
the
Israel.
Boundaries of Israel proper. And Israel has to make up its mind. If it wishes to be a Jewish state or a predominantly Jewish state or a state for the Jewish people primarily, then it has to make a decision with regard to the people who are under its occupation in the West Bank and Gaza, totaling over 3 million at the moment. Does it wish to be a Jewish state that's not democratic? It's up to it. But even so, I think it will not work in its favor.
And what
and
about
likewise,
the
likewise, by the way, for the Palestinians, because the Palestinians also have to make a choice. And they have to make a choice based on their own self-perceived interest.
And what that's, is that choice?
The choice is to
make
the compromise.
What?
Well, there are several issues that have to be worked on the Palestinian side. The Palestinians have to clearly recognize Israel as a Jewish state, as indeed required by Resolution 181 of the United Nations.
A majority ready to do that?
A majority of the Palestinians that have been surveyed in the West Bank and Gaza have shown indication that they're ready to do this conditional upon the acceptance of the Israelis or Israel of their own right to self-determination and freedom their own, in their own state. So what you have is a very strange situation. Both Israelis and Palestinians are ready, but each side conditions its acceptance on the other side's acceptance. And what we need are leaders on both sides who are willing to stand up and actually reflect this average public opinion that already exists on the two sides, and which is what is going to, in fact, allow us to reach a settlement between the two sides.
And break through that kind of waiting game. Sari Nusseibeh, it's great to have you in the studio. I want to turn now to join our conversation from Tel Aviv in Israel. Barry Rubin is with us. He's Director of Global Research and International Affairs Center. He's columnist for the Jerusalem Post, author of Yasser Arafat, A Political Diary. Barry Rubin, thanks very much for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
I'm sure you were watching very closely today. There's a lot of talk about hope. You've been a skeptical observer on this front for a long time. Do you feel hopeful today?
Oh, absolutely. No, I think it's probably the best day in 4.5 years. I think there's a lot of hope. We have to see what happens, because the key issue is, of course, actions, which follow words, and how much is attempted and how successful it is. For example, Hamas immediately announced that Abu Mazen did not speak for them, and what he said and doesn't represent them. Will mm-hmm. they try to break this up with attacks? So, but clearly, this was the absolute necessary beginning and a turning point. And we have to watch what happens in practice. But certainly on the verbal side, everything looks quite good.
Barry Rubin, Sard Nusebi with us here in Boston, says what's imperative is for both sides to get their end game out on the table. No more surprises. Make the compromises to accept each other's end games, or make them fit together and then move toward that goal. Is that practicable in your view? If both sides put their honest end games on the table, are we going to have a deadlock or a movement forward?
Well, I would agree with what he said, but I might amend this slightly by saying as soon as possible. I mean, it's very important to understand in practice what the basic procedure is going to be. The first step, of course, in the days and months to come, is going to be to shore up the ceasefire, to see if, in fact, Palestinian leadership has the willingness and ability to stop the attacks, what's going to happen with prisoner releases, how international force is going to help, what are the mechanisms of cooperation going to be. I mean, there's a huge amount of work to be done in that regard. Then there's a big step, which I think we're talking about roughly 4 months, which is the Israeli redeployment from the Gaza Strip and mm-hmm. from part of the West Bank. And again, for it to succeed, there will be negotiations, arrangement. It will go into great detail. And, of course, people want to see that that's a success. The turnover happens. Everybody's happy about it. The new procedures work well. And there aren't attacks along the border and so on. Development money comes in. At that point, I think then we're going to get then people will start talking about and moving toward the comprehensive negotiations in practice. So I think there's a momentum, we're moving in that direction, but people should understand that there are many steps to be taken, and I think two critical stages leading up to this. Now, the broad outlines, the broad outlines, I think, are clear. But there are some, critical issues to resolve. One of these critical issues is if the Palestinian leadership does precisely what Sari Nusseibeh said, which is to make clear that it's talking about a two-state solution, that refugees will be resettled in the state of Palestine and so on. That's a critical point. If you get beyond that issue, that specific issue, because I think Israel's already made clear that it's ready in principle to accept the state. Then you get into the details of precisely where the borders will be, precisely what every detail will be on East Jerusalem. I don't think that those issues would sink a negotiation. If you get beyond the two-state and the resettlement of the Palestinians who want to go into a state of Palestine.
In other words,
people
you think...
People argue and debate, but that's not going to destroy the possibility of peace.
You think Ariel Sharon can politically ask for the pullout of enough settlements that the Palestinians will be happy and he'll be able to lead Israel toward that solution?
He's already crossed that river, and he took incredible political risk to do so. And he has a national unity government with the Labor Party. I mean, there's clearly a majority to do so. The issues of East Jerusalem are very hot and contentious. But outside of that, and I think even that can be resolved, outside of that, I think the basic decisions have already been made. You know, there are two things that are always very important. One is not to be too optimistic and fall to wishful thinking. But the other is to keep up with the changes which have taken place. This is not 10 years ago.
Yes.
Or even 5 years ago. Yes, people have moved forward.
Barry Rubin, I know it's late in Tel Aviv. You're terrific to stay up and be with us. Thanks so much for sharing your thoughts.
Thank you very much. Bye.
Barry Rubin, Director at Global Research and International Affairs Center in Tel Aviv in Israel. I'm with Sari Nusseibeh tonight, President of Al-Quds University, the Arab University of Jerusalem, with me in the studio. Now joining us from Lower Merion, Pennsylvania, Ian Lustig, Professor of Political Science at the University of Pennsylvania, author of Unsettled States, Disputed Lands, and co-editor of Right-Sizing the State, the Politics of Moving Borders. Ian Lustig, thanks for being with us tonight.
My pleasure.
So we're hearing a lot of hopeful noises today in the sense we just got from Barry Rubin that, yes, this is easy and there are some long-standing problems, but you've got to keep up with the changes. Do you see enough changes afoot in the Israeli and Palestinian publics, in the outlook of their leaderships, for this meeting in Sharm el-Sheikh today to really kick off a season of genuine peacemaking?
Well, yes, I do. We've all seen so many diplomatic minuets end in failure that when we see another one, we know that that's possible. But we've already heard from other guests, and I fully agree with them, that changes in attitudes on the ground, partly as a result of all the bloodshed. So we can't forget that you don't make these kinds of movements towards painful compromises without actually suffering first. And that part of the reason we're here today is because of the tragic losses that have been incurred by both sides. But I think that what we should emphasize is that the leadership has changed. Sharon himself has made a tremendous shift to the left. Now 60% of Likud voters are saying in polls that they fully support the disengagement and essentially the idea of a Palestinian state. I think it's interesting to see the combination of weakness and strength that both Abbas and Abu Mazen and Sharon have that makes this juncture so hopeful. Abbas is strong enough because of his landslide election to exert control over Palestinian areas if Israel delivers things that are important to the Palestinians, like a significant prisoner release, like loosening up the restrictions on the West Bank, like pulling back, like stopping attacks on Palestinians. But he's obviously not strong enough to survive without Israeli sensitivity to his needs. And the Israelis know this. He's strong enough to help them, but not strong enough to survive if Israel doesn't help him.
So do you see then Israel as essentially driving the pace or the success of what happens here?
Yes, I think so. And I think that one reason is because Sharon is strong enough to act against the extreme right in Israel, and he's showing that with respect to the Gaza disengagement. But he doesn't have the confidence in his long-term strength or in his Israel's long-term position that would allow him with equanimity to sabotage a peace process leading toward a two-state solution. He has nailed his flag now to a real two-state solution, and he has shown that he appreciates the dangers that Israel faces demographically, as Sari Nusseibeh said, but also in terms of international isolation. And especially in the context of an Iraq debacle, which will strain the American ability to stay four square behind Sharon no matter what he does.
Sari Nusseibeh, how about it on Abu Mazen, Mahmoud Abbas's side? Hamas has already said, you don't speak for us. We'll do whatever we do. We're not necessarily in on this truce, this effective ceasefire. We've seen so many times these things get killed by a bus exploding here and a suicide bombing there. Can Mahmoud Abbas rein in the militants in the Palestinian community long enough to give Sharon the room to do what he needs to do?
Well, this is the very important question. To tell you the truth, certainly, as far as I can tell, it's not going to be possible for Abu Mazen, for Mahmoud Abbas, to guarantee, simply because he is not, as in fact we heard Israelis say at Sharm el-Sheikh today, he is not a state power with the full control of the borders and of the security and the situation on the ground. Abu Mazen's power really lies in his ability to get the agreement or compliance of his people, of the people in the West Bank and Gaza, for his policies. And so this is really a question of his own credibility. And the credibility is again a function of what Israel or how Israel behaves towards the Palestinians. So in spite of what we heard Hamas spokespeople say, I believe that to the extent that Abu Mazen is allowed to gain credibility in Palestinian eyes as a leader who is able, in fact, to bring about the necessary changes to improve their lives, to that extent, I think there will be compliance on the part of the Palestinians for his strategy.
If he's helped out by his Israeli partner here, Ariel Sharon.
It's a necessary ingredient of what he can do on the ground.
It is quite a dance we've got here. After a break, we're going to hear from Israeli peace advocate Yossi Beilin. We're talking tonight about the Mideast Summit in Egypt and the new hope for peace coming out of Sharm el-Sheikh. My guest, Ayan Lustig, at the University of Pennsylvania, and Sari Nusseibeh, president of Al-Quds University, the Arab University of Jerusalem. You can join this conversation tonight. What should Washington do to encourage peace? And are Sharon and Abbas two leaders who could cut a real lasting deal? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the new hopes for peace out of today's Mideast Summit in Sharm el-Sheikh, Egypt. In the studio with me tonight is Sari Nusseibeh, president of Al-Quds University, the Arab University in Jerusalem, and with me from the University of Pennsylvania, Ayan Lustig, professor of political science there. I spoke earlier with the prominent Israeli peace advocate Yossi Beilin, a longtime Knesset member and former Israeli minister of justice who served in the governments of Yitzhak Rabin, Shimon Peres, and Ehud Barak. He was head of the Israeli team that negotiated the 2003 so-called Geneva Accord, an unofficial peace agreement put forward by peace activists as a model for what might be. He's a leading liberal voice in Israel. He spoke with me from Tel Aviv. I asked Yossi Beilin how hopeful he is after today's meeting between Ariel Sharon and Mahmoud Abbas.
I think that it was an important day, a day which may open a new chapter in our relations with our neighbors. The decision of Egypt and of Jordan to send back the ambassador to Israel is a very important one for us. And of course, the meeting between Sharon and Abu Mazen and their mutual commitment to cease fire may end the 4.5 dark years of the Intifada.
Yossi Beilin, at this point, do you see Israel and the Palestinian Authority as equally committed to a renewed peace process, to peace, and equally capable of delivering on commitment?
There is a big difference between Israel, which is a state, a democratic state, and a stable one, and the Palestinians, which have an authority which its infrastructure had been destroyed in a very, very serious way in the last 4 years. It will be more difficult for them to deliver, but not impossible. And the commitment of Mr. Mahmoud Abbas, Abu Mazen, is a very serious one. He's doing his best in order to implement and fulfill his commitments. And I hope that despite the difficulties, he will be able to succeed. I admit it will be more difficult for him than for us.
And what about Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon? Is he situated politically, philosophically, to deliver on peace, on a settlement?
I think that he is committed very much to the withdrawal from Gaza. I'm not sure whether he is there for the permanent solution. I'm not sure that he is there for paying the price for a Geneva-like solution. I hope I'm wrong. I am, in many ways, enabling him to continue his efforts because he depends on my party in the parliament. And I will give him this support as long as I believe that he is committed to leave Gaza.
And what about Hamas and Palestinian militants? How can they be either brought into this process or kept from derailing it, destroying it?
I think that they are ready for a ceasefire. I'm not sure whether all the groups are ready for that in the same way. At the end of the day, the way to decrease the power of these groups is to create a feeling on the Palestinian side that their life is better when there is a ceasefire, when there are intentions to have peace. Because if there are no hopes on the Palestinian side, desperate people will vote for Hamas. If there is a hope, Hamas will become smaller and smaller.
What do prospects for peace need from the United States at this point?
Monitoring the situation, becoming the referee in our process, updating the roadmap. All the dates are obsolete. The the United States has a special responsibility as the leader of the quartet with Russia, the UN, and the European Union to tell us now what are the new dates for the implementation of the roadmap. If this is happening, I believe that it would be of much help besides the readiness of the United States to help the Palestinians financially and to help them with their security challenges.
Yossi Bilin, you've been working for peace for a long, long time. Many statements of hope coming out of Egypt today. Do you share this hope?
I'm sharing this hope, and I'm afraid. I'm afraid because there is a kind of commitment to something which is too vague. The commitment of Mubarak, Abu Mazen, and Sharon to the roadmap is a very different one for each of them. And what I believe is very, very important is to unite the expectations and to coordinate them. This might be done by the United States. As long as it is not done, the situation will be fragile.
Yossi Bilin, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Yossi Bilin, longtime member of Israel's parliament. He later served as justice minister. He spoke with me from Tel Aviv. Sari Nisebe, you know Yossi Bilin. You hear his optimism, but also his caution, even his fear there, that not everyone's on the same page, the same timetable. There's kind of great vagueness around all this hope at the moment. What clarifies that?
Well, I think, as I was saying earlier, once again, I believe that it's necessary, in order not to repeat the mistakes of the past, to define the end game by the respective leaderships. And secondly, I believe if we are talking about the role of the United States, it is very easy or simple for the United States at this point in time to, in fact, help the two sides clarify that end game. And the best way, in my opinion, for the United States to do this is, again, through following up on the vision, the political vision that was, in fact, expressed by President Bush in June 2002, in which he outlined his commitment to a Palestinian state.
Two-state solution.
A two-state solution, and in which he, in fact, stated very clearly or outlined very clearly the dependence, as he saw it, of Israel's achievement of its own security on the ability of the Palestinian people to achieve their own freedom in quite an unprecedented way, in my opinion. And I believe that follow-up by the U.S. administration on this and a full-time, 24-hour-a-day presence in the region in order to make sure that the two sides, in fact, will go directly to the end game is important is in fact essential to make us able to achieve the aims that we wish to achieve. I want to just say
this.
Please. The problem about doing things step by step at this stage, the problem about the ambiguity that we heard Mr. Bilin talk about, is that given that there is no trust, initially speaking, between the two sides, then each step that you take along the way can, in fact, be not a confidence-building measure, but a case of building mistrust.
Or chance for failure.
And a chance for failure. And this is what we saw happening, especially in the last 10 years. So either you start out with the two sides trusting each other, and then going about implementing steps, not caring or minding too much
the details
about what happens. For example, if there's a bomb attack, or if there is a particular incursion, because the two sides are already in agreement or they trust each other. So you either have this or you have an agreement by the two sides on an end game and then lay out the roadmap in order to reach there.
So have a greater goal and move towards
destination.
It. A lot of callers have been waiting so patiently. I want to begin to invite them in. Roddy is calling from Chicago. Hi, Roddy. You're on the air.
Yes, thank you. I'd like to say, first of all, as an Israeli-American, I'm very, very hopeful, and indeed I'm even optimistic about the unfolding events right now. I think Sharm el-Sheikh signifies the first time in which Israel and the Arabs have actually met at a time when there was actual peace, when there was not an escalation in terrorism. I did not hear of any terrorist attack that occurred throughout this meeting. And this really signifies a very important point.
It's good to hear your optimism, Roddy. Where do you think it can go?
Well, I think that for the first time, Israel has a true partner to negotiate with because Mahmoud Abbas was successful within the first week of his administration. He was successful in deploying several thousand Palestinian policemen in Gaza. He was able to actually stop the rocket attacks into Israel. He was actually able to stop many of the attacks within Gaza. And regardless of what Hamas says, apparently Abbas seems to have some influence over them, where for the past 4 years, Yasser Arafat kept saying that he had no control over Hamas.
Roddy, let us pick up just that point, and thanks for your call. Ian Lustig, how about it? How much actual power over Hamas does Mahmoud Abbas have? If the rockets aren't flying, is that because he's stopped them or because Hamas has simply chosen for its own reasons not to send them flying?
Well, I'm glad you asked me that question, because I think there's been a slight misconception in this conversation about Hamas and the idea that Abbas is going to have to crack down on Hamas and rein it in. One of the huge changes that's occurred and that made this point possible is that Israel has essentially stopped asking for the destruction, the dismantlement of the infrastructure of terror, meaning the dismantlement of Hamas and Islamic Jihad. Instead, Israel has changed the meaning of the dismantlement of the infrastructure of terror to mean dismantling the bomb factories, while implying that the organizations of Hamas can actually remain intact. Remember, Hamas just won an election in Gaza, winning over 70% of the seats. It's the most powerful force in Gaza.
In local elections there.
That's right. So what's important to see in the Hamas statement is essentially saying this: We aren't bound by what Abbas has said, because we already implemented our own ceasefire, our own Hudna, and we will decide if and when we stop that ceasefire. That is an implicit bargain with Israel, saying that Israel has agreed to stop attacking Hamas inside of Gaza, and Hamas has agreed to stop attacking not only inside Israel, but also inside of Gaza at settlers. This is a major agreement, in essence, between Hamas and Israel.
It sounds like
part of this intricate relationship.
Sounds like a very big step. Sari Nusseibeh, you talk about each side laying out its end game, its big ultimate goals. Can Hamas live with the goals that Mahmoud Abbas is likely to articulate? Are they the same?
Well, I think to some extent they can be, but let me just confirm what we heard Professor Lustig say. In fact, there is indeed an implicit agreement between Hamas and Israel, it seems, on this particular issue. And Hamas has probably decided not to carry out any attacks against Israel for as long as they perceive that the Israelis are, in fact, committed to their end of the bargain, and has ceased, in fact, carrying out attacks against them. Now, this is a very important step forward. Now, concerning the end game, what we have at the moment is a leader, Mahmoud Abbas, who's been elected by the majority of the Palestinians as president, and he has, I believe, the right to decide on or to propose the end game to his people. And I believe perhaps a referendum should be prepared, or perhaps even new elections soon to be prepared, that will be based or predicated on those issues. On both sides, by the way, not only on the Palestinian side.
You're saying whose end game, whose big vision the Palestinian people want to support?
Exactly. I mean, Mahmoud Abbas has to lay out exactly what he believes to be a practical solution as an end game. And I believe if there's a need for this, perhaps a referendum should be carried out, or perhaps new elections should be prepared for, in which the people can therefore vote.
That would
for
be
this
fascinating.
New political
Given
program.
That both of these sides have shown real political strength, I want to get another call here. Ellen's calling from Medford, Massachusetts. Hi, Ellen. You're on the air.
Hi. And I want to tell Ian Lustig that I've used your book, The Arabs in Israel, you're one of the writers that I most admire, and I've known you through your writings.
So you're a big fan. What do you think of what's going on right now there, Ellen?
Well, you know, I'm a little skeptical because I've been following since 1967, and since 1979 I reported from Israel and the West Bank for a variety of U.S. publications for about 9 years, and I just wonder what your what the people who are being interviewed would say about their feelings about Ariel Sharon, who has as Ilan Pappé and others have noted, has devoted his life to the construction of the greater Israel, of course. You know, I mean, if there could be a Palestinian state right now, it would be a series of Bantustans. So the question is Mahmoud Abbas bargaining for a series of Bantustans, where I'm sorry to say this, but where the Palestinians say, yes, boss, we accept these Bantustans.
And by Bantustans, you mean kind of West Bank crisscrossed with security fences and checkpoints and the rest?
Well, I mean, the reality in the West Bank, which is what Israel really wants, I mean, let's call a spade a spade. Israel does not want Gaza. Gaza is a headache. What Israel wants is the West Bank with its land and its water resources. And Israel now is a crisscross of settlements ringing every Palestinian village and city with Jewish-only bypass roads.
And you're skeptical they're going to give that up. Ellen, our time is short. Let me put that to Ian Lustig. Do you see that commitment? We talked about it earlier. People are saying Ariel Sharon has had kind of a new vision of what's required. But Ian Lustig, do you see him ready to walk away from what he did work a long time for and what still remains in the minds of some Israelis as a great goal, a kind of greater Israel? What about Ellen's skepticism?
Well, Ariel Sharon, I don't think it's possible to say that he's dedicated his life to building Eretz Yisrael. In fact, it's hard to know what he's dedicated his life for. He has taken just about every position in the book.
A man of parts.
And he is, without a doubt, the most brilliant, effective bureaucrat and tactician in Israeli history. So what he tries to do tactically, he does. What's interesting is that the strategic plans he entertains don't usually work out. In fact, they usually backfire. They did in Lebanon, they did on the West Bank. He intended, he said, in the late 70s, to get 2 million Jews living in the West Bank.
Yeah.
Now he's in the process of withdrawing from parts of it. I think he's taking, in a way, although it may be hard to imagine, the path of least resistance. He really sees this card stacked against Israel being able to rule the territories. And his political future, he's older now, can best be sustained by going with the tide toward peace, and he's capable of delivering it if he gets the proper support from the United States and if the cards fall in the right pattern.
So maybe a kind of powerful pragmatism in this powerful man. Our time is very short now. Sari Nusseibeh, you've been watching this for a long time. In your Palestinian heart tonight, do you really feel optimism, or is that too much to ask?
Well, I believe that there is a great opportunity at the moment. I think that we have moved forward, actually. I mean, looking back over the past not only 10 or 5 years, but over the past 50 years, if you take a wide look like this, you'll find that we have, in fact, moved forward on both the Israeli and the Palestinian side. What's left is very difficult, but it's a shorter distance to cover, and I think we have the ability to cover it. And I hope we'll have the friendship of the United States to help us cover
it. In helping that happen. Well, that sounds like hope to me. Sari Nusseibeh, president of Al-Quds University, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
You're welcome.
And Ian Lustig, University of Pennsylvania, professor of political science there, thank you very much for joining us tonight.
You're welcome.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point with Tom Ashbrook is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.